Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Vanity Fair.
You should go home.
I don't want to go home.
It's Christmas Eve.
Fuck Christmas Eve. Good.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching, a weekly television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Richard Lawson.
I'm Hillary Busis.
And I'm Chris Murphy. And we're here to discuss part 4 of season 4 of HBO's True Detective Night Country.
Later on, actor Kaylee Reese, who plays Detective Navarro, is stopping by to talk about death, Ennis, and the supernatural tones of this season. Richard, do you always do the recap?
Are you the best one? I don't know. I used to be a recapper for Gawker, so I think that's okay. I think our producer
and you did those all out loud.
I remember everything exactly perfectly, as you guys have noticed.
You're not reading from a script.
No, he would never do that.
Anyway, let's do a recap. Thank you. It's Christmas Eve, and the Corpsicle is off to Anchorage, and Liz Danvers finds Navarro's sister Julia in distress.
Okay, I'm just gonna come towards you, okay? Yeah, we need to get you inside.
Navarro and Danvers follow a lead and learn the ice caves share a link in both cases.
Other way to do this would be to track down whoever mapped the cave system.
You got a name?
Otis Hayes.
Wait, Heiss? Otis Heiss? Do you know him?
Julia agrees to go to a treatment facility, but sneaks out and walks out into the darkness and dies. And Navarro spins out.
You want to know what was really wrong with her?
Don't.
It takes us one by one. And you know who's next.
And a sighting of a pink parka takes Navarro and Danvers on the hunt for researcher Raymond Clark, but they find someone else.
Otis? Otis Heiss?
All right, so I am Jewish. I celebrate Christmas now because my husband does.
Welcome.
Thank you. Yes, it's great to be here.
Christmaka.
I have limited experience with Christmas, but I think I can still say this is like the most depressing Christmas I've ever seen in my life.
It's just bleak.
The worst Christmas ever.
For everybody.
Hank is obviously a bad guy, but like seeing him get left at the plane.
Imagine being ghosted in that way. You can't even call it ghost.
She was never real.
Well, wasn't she the woman who she saw him? She was gonna get off the plane, and then she was like, "I'm actually gonna stay on the plane."
No,
you don't think that was her?
No, Chris, he just got
catfished.
I like to think you can't just
get back on the plane and have them take you back to Russia.
Russia's right there. We just say, "Let's go to Russia."
Not how planes work.
No. I like to believe that. Maybe
it's
that's
not
like, I really
it's
didn't
like the
Hank.
W train. If you stay on long enough, it just keeps going in the other direction.
Those little planes, Alaska to Russia. I will say I did feel really bad for Hank when him getting ghosted. That was just sad. It's just sad.
I mean, everyone in this town's getting ghosted in one way or another.
Yeah. Ooh, God. The Julia stuff is very rough.
Yeah. Yeah. We have been saying for a few weeks now that we didn't see things going well for Julia. And unfortunately, we were actually more correct than I thought we were going to be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I didn't think this was going to happen. And I also think for
you didn't think she was going to die?
I didn't think it would be this soon.
Okay.
Yeah.
I also didn't think it would arrive in the middle of an episode.
Okay. I just feel like she was a Beth March ticking time bomb from the beginning. You don't introduce like troubled sister and that.
Who's like having apocalyptic visions and, you know.
No, she does not get to episode six. No. Like, that's just not the way television works.
Yeah, I was surprised. Well, I was surprised by how it went down, too. And I thought that was actually, I mean, it was sort of a really eerily and deeply, darkly, sort of beautifully sad seeing her walking sort of naked into the snow, into the dark.
It seemed like what she wanted.
It seemed, and maybe she knows to get out. Maybe she knows this whole town is doomed and we don't need to be here anymore.
Last week, Navarro said to Danvers, do you ever think about that, just like walking away into nothing? Mm-hmm. And you're like, so her sister kind of almost fulfilled Navarro's prophecy, you know, and I think there's a really sad poetry in that. And I thought, you know, just between Hank and Navarro, obviously these are very different kinds of losses, one much more extreme than the other, but like, Hank did not react angrily. He just kind of was like, probably a problem with her mom or her cell phone service or whatever.
Yeah, that's denial.
and Navarro kind of does the denial thing for a little bit. I'm fine, whatever. Mm-hmm. She hangs up the phone and when Pryor says, is everything okay? And she's like, yeah, it's fine. She waits for Danvers to get into a long monologue about how when you're dead and nothing, you know, there's no afterlife. And then she says, oh, by the way, my sister killed herself.
A great way to make somebody feel shitty.
Horrible. Yeah, and it was even worse, too, because Danvers picked her up off the street. Danvers is now somewhat connected to Julia, having found her on the street, too.
Yeah.
You know?
Danvers is a carer, you know, when it comes to it, and tried, and obviously Navarro tried. Maybe there was no helping Julia, at least in that environment. And then, of course, the anger for Navarro does arrive.
Yeah.
But it's, I don't think she thought she was actually going to, like, beat that guy up. I think she knew how that was going
to
go.
Yeah, I think she wanted to. She feels guilt.
She wants to feel hurt, physical hurt.
To cover the emotional hurt. The emotional hurt and the guilt that she feels because she put her in the lighthouse. She knew Julia didn't want to go to the lighthouse, but it reached a point where there was nowhere else for her to go. And sort of on her watch, in a way, this is another person that she's lost.
Well, yeah, because she's like, she wants to stay at the lighthouse and just, you know, sit in front of the door, but you can't do that. You can't just be hovering.
No, you can't be hovering. And so it just to see her rage out against these men and get really, I gotta say, whoever did the fight choreography and it was very visceral.
That's where you can see that Kaylee Reese knows how to fight.
She knows how to fight.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
In a real way.
And she also, like, this is maybe a dumb thing to say, but she knows how to, like, wear a bruise and a cut on her face. Mm. Like, I know it's makeup, but, like, it just looks so much more convincing knowing that she is probably, her face has looked like that in her past line of work.
Yeah, she knows how to act it. Like,
the wincing and the sort of physical pain of it. Yeah.
When her pseudo boyfriend reset her hand, you think he's going to propose, the crack. You think he's going to, like, propose, and she's like, don't do that. But it's just a distraction for him to just put it back into place. Dislocated things really give me the heebie-jeebies, and that was maybe as scary as Lundy last episode.
Too. Yeah, it's something I've said before, but like just let him love you.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
Let him in.
And I'm like, well, how many times does she push him away before he's like, well, forget it. And I was worried that was going to happen.
Maybe that there's not that many other people in town.
That's true. I mean, as we've seen with Danvers, who
slept with all of them.
They're like, oh, you really slept with everybody. Yeah.
There was like a census, and she was ticking off names one by one.
Right.
It's interesting. I know we said this earlier, and maybe we were totally off base and whatnot, and maybe I was so like crazy this episode, but did anybody else feel a little bit of a spark when Navarro touched her arm at the very beginning of the episode, Danvers?
I was like,
maybe there's something. And then last episode we had Hank sort of out of nowhere being like, don't Mrs. Robinson my son.
Yeah.
And Danvers throws the coffee.
And we had talked
face.
About that in the first episode of this season, like, well, there was some confusion about whether Pryor was Danvers' son.
Yes.
But then there was also like, well, there's something there. And I think that these past two episodes, 3 and 4, have really sort of ramped that up where she's like saying like, that's my boy. He's abandoning Christmas to be, and his wife like is maybe being a little insensitive to the fact that there's, like, multiple murders being investigated right now.
And it is his job.
But, like, at the same time, it's like, you're not really going for work. You're going for her.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and it feels less sexual than, like, her molding him into her.
Yeah, right. It feels, like, more mother-sonny, that aspect.
She did lose a son, so.
And she lost a
son.
Yeah,
and you are, like, he is now going to, like, follow in her footsteps in this way. And, like, she is going to turn him, when whatever it takes, she's going to turn him into a great cop.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, she's not really paying appropriate attention at this point to Leah, who is now spray painting the mine company's front door.
Which seems like a great way to get yourself murdered. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely. She's storming out of the house on Christmas, and Liz throws a whole goddamn turkey out into the trash.
That turkey looks good.
I know that Danvers was being kind of shitty to her to Leah in this episode, but, like, anytime someone, like, throws out the dinner they either made or were going to make, I hate it. It makes me so sad.
That's a trope. Yeah, that is a trope that gets to the heart.
Yeah. Like, a dejected, like, oh, never mind, you know. Because everyone had to be kind of horrible and alone on this Christmas. Well, I mean, no, Leah's not alone. She's with more of her, you
native
know, sort of almost
family.
Chosen family
yeah,
and
chosen
whatever.
Family,
and
family.
Yeah, they're the only ones who seem to be having an okay time.
Yeah,
but except that she's mad at Pryor because he didn't come home, and so the kid might have gone to bed sad.
And Danvers wasn't completely alone because she got zooted and blasted and drove on over to her other boyfriend's house, Ted, which was crazy. And I was really worried just because I think there was some foreshadowing. We still don't know exactly what happened to her son, right?
No.
We don't. Mm-hmm. We have no idea. But with there's been drunk driving in the air since the first episode.
We know that his name is Holden.
We know his name is Holden.
Yeah.
We know he's no longer with us.
Which is a name that is freighted with symbolism.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Very true.
Freighted.
And we know from the first episode, like, she almost gets in that car crash, and there's that drunk woman who's drunk driving. So I'm going to go out on a limb and think it's probably maybe she got drunk and there was a drunk driving accident, and that's what maybe happened.
That seems to be what the show is leading
that's
to,
what seems
at least.
To be.
And, you know, that would cause you a greater amount of guilt if it is an accident that was your fault.
That was your fault. Sort of a logical conclusion.
She doesn't seem that sad about her dead husband.
No, she doesn't really seem to care about that. But I was really nervous just because there was a moment where, like, she was drunk in a car driving, and then Navarro was grief driving, and I was like, oh, God, what if they crash or something? I was like,
that's Grey's Anatomy.
That's
Grey's Anatomy coming out of you.
Yeah.
The melodrama. But I Danvers drinking and showing up at Ted's house, I thought was pretty tough.
There was a moment of respite where it was like, we get the gag about the teeth whitener.
Yeah.
We get
Elf.
Danvers laughing, wholeheartedly laughing, which is the first time we've seen her do this since we've known her. And then, of course, the scene immediately then turns dark again.
Yeah.
Like, we had a little bit moment of, like, some sort of Christmas cheer at some one man's expense. But, like, but yeah, and then he says the thing where he was like, after the thing happened with Holden and the husband, like, you were just different.
What are you saying? I got too emotional?
No, you just got fucking shittier. Told people they sucked at their jobs.
It's because they sucked at their jobs.
Nobody wanted to work with you, Liz. Nobody wants to work with you now. You're still a fucking mess. Take a look around. It's Christmas Eve and you're here busting my balls.
Yeah. You're here too, busting mine, aren't you?
Liz. Liz! Do not fucking drive.
Fuck off, Ted.
While also saying that, like, maybe he did get her out of town because she was better than him, you know?
Yeah. Two things can be true.
Yeah,
it feels like this episode we have a lot of kind of character beats and less progress on the murder, which is, you know, seems fine to me, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we do get a little bit further with the murder.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, we have a great spooky cliffhanger.
Yes.
We have, the search.
Otis.
The search for Otis Heiss.
Otis Heiss. That was creepy. The dredges that used to be working.
That's a great set piece going into that creepy oil
refractory. What was that?
Refinery or something.
Yeah,
where, you know, it's just all of these dead machines, and it's even darker than outside somehow, and there's, like, a sad little, like, creepy Christmas tree.
Yeah,
and
Navarro says of them when they were working that they sort of had, like, a kind of, like, almost terrible majesty to them. Like, there are these things tearing stuff out of the earth that we probably shouldn't be burning anymore, and yet there was something sort of awful in the kind of old sense of the word about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a good setting. So I want to talk – we should talk about Otis because he's new to this cast of characters. He's found by Pryor, at least in name, because he searched a database for similar symptoms or similar causes of death to those of the scientists that, you know, are our central case here.
And sort of convenient that one exists, but we'll allow it.
Yeah, and then it just so happens that not only is there someone else who experienced this, But also, oh, wait, no, he's, like, actually still in town. Like, he's still here. Like, I thought that was maybe a little bit too tidy mm-hmm. in its... I thought maybe they were going to find this guy, and he was going to have experienced something similar somewhere else.
Yeah.
But now it seems like, oh, no, he's directly involved.
And
in
he's
this.
Sort of living as a vagrant.
Wearing Annie's coat.
Yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, give...
Or I guess it's Clark's coat, but Annie had it. Yeah.
But no, it feels maybe a little deus ex machina-y that, you know, we're in episode four. Like, yeah. Oh, maybe this guy we've never heard of before is actually...
deeply involved.
Right. Yeah. But he is at least pushing us on into the titular Night Country by saying, Clark's gone. He went underground, he said, I think. Like, he went underneath to hide out. He's in the Night Country now. We're all in the Night Country now. And so it's like, okay, so he... as crazy as he seems, as unreliable as he might be, he is pointing us toward the end game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are signs that, as crazy as he might be, that, like, he could be right. I mean, we have these ice caves, right? Where mm-hmm.
Which also seems like a great creepy place to shoot some scenes.
100%. It looked a lot like that's where Annie, you know, died, it seems, mm-hmm. or at least got attacked. And you know, we're told by Danvers' other boyfriend, the geology teacher, that they're not safe and that no mm-hmm. one should go in. So it already yeah. is setting up sort of like an epic finale yeah. of them, you know.
Yeah, smash cut to them inside.
Inside the caves, yeah. you know.
Yeah.
By a thread.
Exactly. And as drunk as she is, Danvers does make a connection between the video of the scientists right before they went missing and then were found dead. And in the Annie video, there is a sort of flash of light. And she says, oh, someone cuts the power. Mm-hmm. And then they say, well, they must have had generators set up in this ice cave, wherever this ice cave is, mm-hmm. which is like, okay, so were people living there? Mm-hmm. Maybe yeah. were the scientists maybe doing, had they come across... their, you know, the research that was alluded to by the teacher is like they're like basically they could if their experiments work out, they can cure every disease. Like mm-hmm. it's like this is like the God, you know, this is like the God discovery. Like we could yeah. kind of conquer death. Is that what they found in the cave? Is that why they set up shop with electricity in the cave? Or
yeah, but yeah, tapping into a cave, you know, digging too deep and finding something that you shouldn't have found kind of goes mm-hmm. along with your earlier theory, Richard. It also feels sort of like Oracle at Delphi-y, mm-hmm. like, yeah. you know, there's this hole in the ground and they're breathing something in and like the people think that it is like this magic supernatural thing, but it's actually like a hallucinogen yeah. that is making them go crazy.
That is making
exactly.
them crazy.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Something that really sort of came to the forefront that might be connected to that is this goddamn spiral that mm-hmm. is just popping up all
yeah.
over. Because if you think about it, if you traced it, you go all the way down to the... it sort of looks like a drill. If,
yeah.
if you think about it,
yeah.
it goes all the way down mm-hmm. to the center of, you know? So maybe there's something...
I hadn't looked
that.
At it as spiraling down, but yeah, you're right. It could
it
be.
It could
yeah.
be going down mm-hmm. into the earth.
Time is a flat circle. It yeah. could go both ways.
And, at least a couple people have left them as almost clues, you know.
Oliver Tadak?
Yeah, like he leaves a stone behind. It's also written on the floor. And then Navarro asks point blank the people who are living out on this little settlement on the ice what it is, and they pointedly do not answer her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They tell her to leave. So people know what this is. Fiona Shaw's character alluded to that in an earlier episode. What do we think about her this episode where she's having this fabulous, like,
solo.
Rich lady Christmas?
She had such a spread for no one.
Yeah.
That,
yeah.
like...
girl, you're gonna eat... She had a cheese plate. So presumably that's before the entrees, you know?
Like, yeah. yeah.
Oh, man. Lord. Given the current discussion about academia, I loved her backstory being, yeah. I was an academic and I was doing this very important work and then I realized that everything... that my life was meaningless and yeah, my work was meaningless and I left.
So I moved to the middle of, like, literally, like the end of the earth.
Because yeah. it's quiet.
I had to yeah. get so far away yeah. from academy.
So if Julia and Navarro had a kind of little running joke before Julia died about all the groceries being expensive, $20 cookies, how fucking much did that Christmas meal cost?
Well, and she must have had to, like, send away for all of those
exactly.
ingredients.
Oh, 100%.
Those aren't things that you're just going
to
find.
And William Sonoma delivers to that town?
And was... and I guess Navarro was always going to... it was always just going to be the two of them. Was Navarro always going to come over? Did she just...
no,
sort of
I think that...
she's appeared.
I guess it's possible yeah. that Rose is clairvoyant.
Yeah.
She sees her dead yeah. boyfriend, mm-hmm. who is Travis Cole's... Russ Cole's father.
Yes.
So, you know, there's something going on there.
There's something going on there, and it does feel...
I do also love the idea, though, that she was just like, this is all for me.
I'm going to wear my red velvet gown and eat.
Or it's her and all of her ghost friends, which also, you know, if that's how you want to celebrate Christmas, she's the only one having a good time. Her and the native, like, women.
I mean, the ghost thing, too, with Rose, is her name even really Rose? We don't even know. Mm. It takes a really sort of dark turn with Navarro by the end of the episode, where it's like, Navarro's like, what happened to my mother? What happened to Julia is maybe happening to me. And she goes so far as to sort of leave Liz Danvers in a pretty precarious situation where they don't know, like, there's a man running. They don't know if he's armed or anything. She just sort of, like, completely just focuses on something different in the image of her sister sort of floating face down in the dredges, which seemed to be maybe a premonition that didn't seem to be real. I don't know. I'm very worried about Navarro's.
She does not end this episode in a good. She's got blood coming out of her ear
and is spiraling.
She's gone
like almost full Blair Witch standing in a corner. Yes, like, you know,
that's exactly what it seems feels
yeah,
like.
Yeah, and that's not great.
It feels not great, and I don't know if like
she says when she's telling Danvers about her sister's death, she's like she knew something was coming for her, and now it's coming for me. Yeah. Now it's coming to claim me or whatever the language is she uses. Like it happened to her mother too. And yes, could that just be a metaphor for
generational trauma?
Generational trauma, hereditary mental illness, sure. But also maybe something slouching toward her that is of, you know, deep in the earth.
And now
like
the last two episodes have ended this way with some sort of foreboding sign from a demon.
Yeah. I guess the question is, we now have two episodes left. Do we feel like we can get to a point where the edges are rounded in a satisfying way? Like, because, you know, remember like on Game of Thrones where the story kept expanding and expanding and expanding, and by season seven you were like, wait a second, they haven't started to tie anything back together.
And none of these people are ever on the same continent,
right.
Let alone.
So like, how is this all going to have a grand convergence and a sort of satisfying ending?
And then Game of Thrones pulled that off. It's very satisfying ending.
As did Lost. Both showed beautifully. I mean, obviously this is working on a much shorter runway, and I do feel like as much as Otis's arrival feels a bit convenient, as you said, Hillary, I think that that is going to be the sort of center thing around which a lot of things converge. Like, I hope, anyway. Like, we now have introduced the premise that is suggested by the show's title. and we're now coming close to the place where Annie K. died, presumably the place where Clark currently still is. I mean, we don't know that for certain.
He doesn't have a code, so he might not be doing so great.
Yeah, he might be gone.
I like how tight the show is. I think that six episodes feels like long enough that we can have a beat like Hank getting ditched by his mail order bride. Like, that doesn't have anything to do with the story. It doesn't need to be there, but it's illustrative and it builds him into something a little bit deeper. But at the same time, there's not so much time that we can really head out into left field, like past a bunch of red herrings that are going to end up being dead ends.
Right. No, exactly. I mean, I think that one plot line that we haven't spent a ton of time on for the past couple episodes is Pryor. He and his wife are having a lot of problems. I don't think that marriage is maybe long for the world, but we'll see.
I mean, certainly not if he keeps, like, leaving on Christmas to, like, answer the phone.
And then sneaking back into bed and just saying sorry kind of petulantly.
Knocking over things when he does it, waking her up.
Like, they have a little kid. Come on.
But we had joked on, I think, the first episode of this season that, like, he had strong Evan Peters in Mayor of Easttown energy, where it's like, which that did not end well for that character. I don't know now that the sister has died, I don't know if they would put another death like that into the show. But I'm starting to wonder...
Like another, like, death of an innocent kind of thing feels like too much.
But I'm kind of wondering if we get a situation where Danvers rescues him from imminent death and she essentially sacrifices herself, thus kind of like atoning for whatever happened with her son, kind of like Al Pacino at the end of Insomnia, another detective thing set in Alaska, where he won't let Hilary Swank like go down the dark path. Maybe we're building with Pryor toward, she's molding him into her, but she's actually going to realize, wait, I don't want to do that. I want to make him better. I want to make, like, he can't abandon his family.
Well, I mean, and then there's also the alternative, which is, you know, he is Clarice Starling in this world. Like, he he is young and he's kind of idealistic. And
freshman.
He's getting to a place where he's going to be more
able and capable, but, you know, lose part of himself along the way. And that also feels, you know, like a possible turn for the character to take.
He is a rare, it's other than, I mean, he's obviously not great at being married, but he's also like, what, 25?
Yeah.
But he's one of the rare decent men
right.
on the show so far.
And should, can you know, there be a decent man in that, Ennis?
Well, right. that's what made me right. think.
I mean, Oliver is maybe, we don't know much about him. He seems protective, certainly, of his life, but, like, is he
Quavik's bad? Quavik's good.
But is that, like, should we be trusting that? Like, is there a decent man in... Mm-hmm. The whole thing really begins with Navarro, like, beating up a guy. There's a lot of male-on-female aggression. Maybe the lesson is you can't trust everyone. Maybe Quavik is actually bad news, even though he seems to be genuinely so lovely the whole entire time, so that would be hard to believe. But I'm just now like, well, we're spitting out theories.
And it's good.
Well, hashtag he's, not all men.
He's good enough for... It's implied that this is... Navarro's first male relationship, you know, because Danvers had asked, like, are you going back to girls or, like, whatever.
Still with Quavik.
I'm rooting for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are a couple decent men, but, like, I don't know. I just, the prior of it all, that character was introduced in this kind of significant way, and I do feel a little bit like the wheels have been spinning on that somewhat, because, like, we've gotten the same fight with the wife now three times. The same sort of, like, oh, when she says jump, I say, you know, how high, like.
Has a similar thing with the dad.
He's having good luck finding things out, but also Navarro is kind of showing him up by being like, well, I don't know, I went and talked to people rather than just Googling. You know.
Well, it feels like if there were another innocent or sacrifice or something that happened in that way, it feels like it might be Leah, just given Leah's proximity.
Oh, but that's going to really destroy Danvers if that happens.
It would destroy Danvers if that happens, because that would be her second kid whom she loses. And then also the similarities, and Isabel said this last week, that she looks a lot like Annie Kay. Like, there's like, they even noticed that when they were in the hair and makeup trailer together. And that if there's something that's targeting Native women or targeting Native people, it might be that Leah's the one who's most at danger. And now she's as far away from Danvers as possible, sort of, right now.
Right.
So, which is arguably the person that Danvers cares about the most. So I'm worried about her.
I wonder if, like, Leah getting involved with the protesting and stuff in this as a way that Annie Kay was as well, like— might Leah get led to where Annie Kay got led? I mean, are there people we haven't met, or like a certain sort of organization, a protest organization that like Annie Kay got too deep in with, and maybe that's where Leah's headed? Like, does
I mean, if she winds up being like bait for them to catch, I mean, that's pretty dark. That feels like old True Detective. I don't know.
Yeah, not bait. I just mean, like, are things going to start to kind of echo the past, and then Danvers has to, and Navarro have to kind of intervene to stop that from happening? You know, like, I don't know.
Break the cycle.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how involved Leah is in the central mystery, how involved Pryor is ultimately going to be, you know, because it's time to start sort of setting everyone up for their own individual endings.
Yeah.
I mean, traditionally, like, the penultimate episode is where, like, the real shit happens, and then...
Yeah, I think that was true of past True Detective seasons as well. Yeah. So, we'll see. But, yeah, I mean, this episode felt pretty supernatural to me.
Yeah.
I gotta say. I mean, a horror... I'll clarify that. This episode was almost... half of it pure like horror.
I mean, Julia's seeing her mother under the bed, like,
yeah, we have several jump scares. Mm-hmm. We have a creepy location for a sort of final moment, you know, a crazed man running or skittering around in the dark.
With like, one eye. Again, one eye thing is also
the bleeding ear. Yeah.
Yeah. So
we have Fiona Shaw's sumptuous spread.
Right.
Yeah. For a ghost, maybe.
Yeah.
Probably.
Rose, she hasn't lived here in 30 years.
If she has been dead the whole time, then that's dumb. But also, I don't know. Maybe I wouldn't hate it.
I believe it.
Yeah. But that was the celebrated actress Fiona Shaw. She lived here in the 70s.
Still watching. We'll be back in just a moment when we return to conversation with Kaylee Reese, who plays Detective Navarro.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
So we saw in part four of the 6-part True Detective series that Navarro really, really can take a punch. She really was worse for the wear by the end of the episode.
But she, you know, she took a licking and kept on ticking.
Yeah, she really did.
Yeah. This was a pretty significant episode for Navarro, our beloved, troubled Evangeline Navarro, but also a big episode for the actor who plays her, Kaylee Reese, who has not had a ton of experience in acting, is kind of new to the profession. But I think the whole show leading up to this, but really in this episode, proves that she has a calling.
Yeah, she's got the chops.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that this will not be the last time we see her. I got a chance to talk to Kaylee about landing this role and becoming friends with Jodie Foster, how her background as a boxer, which is what her job was before she became primarily an actress, came in handy while making the show. So, yeah, enjoy our conversation. Hi, Kaylee. So nice to meet you.
Wooning Matampin. Good morning, and thank you for having me, Hillary. It's very a huge pleasure. Can't wait.
So obviously, you had acted before True Detective, but hadn't done something kind of. I mean, you had made a movie, but you hadn't done, you know, a big mainstream project like this. So tell me a little bit about joining the show and why Navarro kind of spoke to you.
Casting director was looking for Navarro, and saw me. And Issa, they made the conscious decision to make Navarro part of the community, half indigenous, and they were looking for a Native American actress. And they showed her me, and I became Navarro, basically it kind of thing. I did audition, and I knew I was going to get the part, especially when I read the part was, spoke with Issa. I was really intrigued about it. Huge True Detective fan. And she was just somebody I could totally relate to on so many different levels. And then, you know, the brain of Issa Lopez, the imagination, the way she elegantly puts these themes into one thing that just gels together and works. And that was really what spoke to me. But a Navarro struggle between the two, you know, she's half Dominican, half Inupiaq, indigenous, and she's surrounded by a world that she's not really a part of but wants to be, and she's been through some shit. She's been through some things, and she's like a badass with a big heart, you know what I mean? And I can definitely relate to that. And, you know, it was a big thing to take on. It was pretty intimidating to be a fan. You know, they said Jodie Foster. I'm like, wait, what? That's how I got on. I got the call, and immediately Issa said, congratulations, and I'm sorry. I was like, yay, wait, what? Like, kind of like, okay. You know, I do things, evidently, I do the hardest thing first. I kind of get thrown into the deep end and sink or swim. And, you know, I've been learning how to swim. And it was just an amazing blessing. So that's, and here we are, my third job with this mega monster of a project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is not the typical early acting career.
Not at all. Not at all.
Tell me about the first time that you got to really spend time with Jodie Foster. What did you guys do? What did you talk about? How did you get to know each other?
The first time we met was actually in Iceland where we shot. It was the very first rehearsal. So it wasn't like we had a meet and greet. It wasn't like we had coffee. It wasn't like we had any kind of Zoom. And I'm like, you know, trying to fathom over the entire summer, like, I'm going to be working with Jodie Foster. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And, you know, always have some kind of thought on who people are, who they look like they would be. And then, you know, I'm just tiptoeing into this industry, like, hey guys, here I am. And then I'm like, with this legend, hard-hitting, Academy Award winning, like, I grew up watching her movies, and I had a fangirl moment, like a motherfucker. I was like, oh my God, she's walking through the door. She's like, hi. I'm like, what's up? How you doing? Nice to meet you. You know, I had to try to play it cool. But she was amazing, man. She's such a, I went in there doing this project and left with a friend. She's my homie now. And she's was just so pleasantly kind, very open. She was very interested in what everybody else's ideas were. She was very collaborative, and she just really was there to tell this story. Hilarious. And it was an amazing experience. I mean, what better way to learn and get into this industry than to have kind of like an almost like a mentor, somebody to observe and learn off of for your third project and such a big project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned that she's really funny. And I mean, the show is really funny, too, which is a kind of a pleasant surprise. Like you mentioned being mm-hmm. a fan of the original True Detective. And, you know, that first season is so great and so compelling. But like, it's not that funny. Like, yeah, no. In That Country really is.
Yeah, it's funny, like, because we would read and rehearse, and then we'd be in doing the scene, and the scene would be, like, something serious. But then watching it, I'm like, yo, I laughed a lot with this one, because the dynamic between Danvers and Navarro is pretty funny.
Yeah, there's a great moment in this episode, episode 4, where they're going to see the science teacher to try to get him to explain where that video is coming from. And Danvers is like, stand in front of me to Navarro, and she's like, you, him too?
Just like, yeah, like, you gotta be kidding me. That was so funny, because it was something that I could tell. And then her reaction was like, yeah, I know, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you gotta love Danvers. She does what she wants.
We call her an Alaskaran. She's just like, she's just like so oblivious. She makes these horrible jokes. And then she actually is funny. She does whatever she wants. She's this big, but she has the personality of like King Kong. It's insane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I spoke to Issa Lopez also, and she described the show as kind of essentially a rom-com between Danvers and Navarro, which I also thought was like, did you feel that vibe between you and Jody?
Yeah, absolutely. It was like somebody you love to hate that you know so well, but you absolutely can't stand them, but you love them so much. And like, I honestly, if one of them, if Danvers or Navarro ever needed to get like life saved, they wouldn't think twice about saving each other. You know what I mean? Mm. So it definitely is a rom-com.
I guess I don't want to shift the mood too much, but you have a lot of heavy stuff in this episode that I definitely want you to dig into a little bit. That last scene of Navarro and Julia talking, you know, before she goes into the institution and before she, you know, dies. It's really emotional and it's very fraught. Tell me, is there anything specific about shooting that scene that you remember that stands out to you?
Well, yeah, initially meeting Akka, which she plays Julia Navarro as my little sister, like immediately she became my real little sister. You know, we were very relatable. She's an amazing human person. And just because I have this thing with, like Navarro, with just women and girls, and I've worked with young girls in group homes for a very, very long time. Not saying she was in a group home, but I just have this protective aspect about me that I can relate to with Navarro. And we hung out a lot just to, you know, this is her first time acting. This is not my like 15th, but I have a little bit, you know, show the little ropes. And this was a heavy, heavy role for her. And, you know, getting to know her, I just wanted to make sure she had all the support in the world. So it wasn't far to pull from. You know what I mean? Just because of a lot of time we spent together personally. And just to imagine what that felt like, you know, that's Navarro's one thing that's holding things together for her. Because if it wasn't for Julia, she wouldn't make the decision to go to the military. She wouldn't have made the decision probably to be, you know, try to be in this box to make things work in this community. She would do things her own way for sure, because she would only have to worry about herself, not Julia. So that was, you know, she wanted to make it seem like everything was going to be okay, but she actually, Julia was the one trying to make sure Navarro was okay in that whole aspect, because Navarro was losing it because she felt like she was losing Julia.
Yeah, you kind of feel like Julia kind of knows, I think, what she's going to do. It seems pretty clear, like, how things are going to end for her, and, like, Navarro's the only one maybe who doesn't see that.
Yeah, Navarro tries not to, because Julia's more, you know, Navarro's caught between these two worlds, the spiritual and the logical, and she's trying to ride that middle line, where Julia is way more spiritual and way more connected like their mother is, hence the reason why Julia is always a reminder, I'm not mom, but she's not really trying to convince Navarro, she's trying to convince herself as well. So it's Julia definitely knew, and maybe Navarro knew in some aspect too, but she didn't know why she knew, and she didn't know what she knew in that moment as well.
Yeah, so she has several different reactions at different moments to, you know, this horrible thing that happens to her, this horrible, you know, family tragedy. She goes and she finds that guy from the domestic violence call from the beginning of the series, and she, like, you know, attacks him and then gets beaten up. So obviously, like, with your background as a fighter, like, was it tricky to learn, like, stage fighting? Is that, like, a totally different skill?
You know, I thought at first it would be the one thing to unlearn is, like, naturally when I've been boxing for over 20 years. So, like, naturally, I'm going to always look like a boxer. But he's consciously going into the just industry, especially with Navarro. She doesn't come from a boxing background. So it's like, I got to kind of unlearn that a little bit. But because I've been boxing for so long, it was easy for me to get the distance between not hitting somebody and hitting somebody, because I know how close I need to be to hit somebody. So that was probably, like, I love stunt rehearsals. We had an amazing stunt team and amazing scene partners. So it was just to learn the different techniques of what it means to be like, to act like you're beating somebody or getting beat up versus actually really hit. Because I got the hitting people down, you know, I can, I got that down. But no, it was fun. I would say that it was definitely a lot of fun. It was like my bread and butter.
How many stunts were you doing yourself?
Everything. I've done every stunt. The only thing I didn't do was like things from like falling, like from things. But I did. I said, if there's everything, I want to do everything. Like, I want to be the Tom Cruise of this thing. I want to do everything, man. So I did pretty much almost everything.
That's a good comparison to make. Yeah, that's a...
Yeah.
And then later, she goes over to Danvers and, you know, she's still feeling kind of numb. And Danvers has that whole kind of tantrum where she starts yelling about how there is nothing after death and, like, everybody is alone. And then, you know, Navarro has to tell her what happened to Julia. Like, that seems like that was a pretty intense two-hander for you guys, you and Jody.
Yeah, it was... That scene is really, I like that scene as well, because for the first time you kind of see Danvers give, being a friend to Navarro in that moment.
Did anything stand out from shooting it?
Yeah, I mean, I've personally, you know, I can pull from a few places having to say somebody close to you, especially a sibling, has died. You know what I mean? So that was, and again, just a personal relationship and knowing what Akka, you know, just being a big sister to her too, you know, just imagining that. And it was a heavy scene, and just the whole mental illness about everything, you know, you either know somebody who's been through that or has somebody who's been through that, at least in my experience. And it was tough, but again, I had a lot of support, and you know, it was like telling somebody's truth. It might not have been a mine, but it was Navarro's truth in that point. And I think it was more or less Navarro's finally saying it to somebody, finally getting it out. And because of their Danvers and Navarro's connection, whether it's tainted now or not, they're friends, and they were really good friends, and they understand each other. She trusts Danvers.
And then they just get back to work, which is kind of like, you want to tell her, like, take a breather, take a minute, like, go home. But you know, I guess that this is just kind of how both of them process things.
Yeah, they, in the true detective fashion, you know, they bury themselves in their work. That's how they cope with their messy lives.
The topic of missing and murdered Indigenous women is very important to you personally, and that you've done a lot of work in that topic. How do you think that the show and Issa handle it this season?
I think, you know, it's a tricky, that's what I'm learning early in this industry, is this tricky thing to try to get a point across without going too far, where people just, you know, you can give somebody too much information at once. You know, so people have to process it on their own. Lisa did a very good job. She's been telling these types of stories in her own directorial career for a long time. And being from Mexico, she's seen, and being from Mexico City, a place that happens just like it does in Canada and in America and in most Indigenous places around the world, are just targeted people. She's done a really good job in telling that story. And I believe making this story based around Navarro's nemesis, which is finding what happened to Annie Kay, which also kind of intertwines with what happened to her mom, which happened, you know, that she just has this thing. And that's kind of she's been chasing this case. You know, we've done a good job with that, touching on it, making that the kind of the core of what's really going on. Would I have liked to see it more? Yeah, but not this story. I think it does a good job of that balance, because it's all about balance. And then it just raises questions, and it raises curiosity. Curiosity raises questions. Questions raises conversation. Conversation, you know, awareness, and then hopefully leads to change. So I think we did a pretty good job.
Yeah. And it raises it and it explores it without being like preachy or, you know, like hitting you over the head.
Some people, you know, shy away from that.
So at the end of this episode, you and Danvers head to, I guess, what is it, like an oil rig, like out on the ice, and you're going to look. You wind up finding Otis Heiss, and there's that really creepy final shot where Navarro is just like bleeding from the ear and staring from the Christmas tree. When you like read that stuff, were you just like, oh my god, like what is going on in this universe? Like, it's really dark.
I'm like, dude, Issa, what do you think of on a daily basis? This is awesome.
Like, this is just what's inside your head all the time. Yeah.
This is what you think about, like, drinking coffee in the morning? Holy shit. I was just like, I was like, no, Navarro gets it. She's gonna, no. Like, I was like, oh, no. But I'm like, nah, she's strong enough, but she's still between two. If anybody can get out of the trance or whatever you want to call it that mm-hmm. these people are getting called to, Navarro can get out of it. You know, she's going to touch it there, and she's almost like going to find out what's on the other side so she can report back to herself, kind of a thing. But I was like, oh my God, that whole in the dredges was, it all brings everything together. Like, oh man, what is going on here? It just kind of sets you up for the next chapter.
When you like step onto that set, are you just, how creepy is it in real life versus, you know, what it looks like on the show?
It's creepy as hell. Whatever it looks like, it's cold, it's creepy, it's really dark. No, it is. And then, you know, just the places in the set that they were building or the locations we were going to, it just added to it. Like, you know, as you're reading, you know, I have a very vivid imagination, so I imagine what it's going to look like. Then I get there, I'm like, oh, this is 10 times better than what I could imagine. So it helps you get into that feel, that creepy, you know, get chicken skin and like, you know, it's not real, but it felt real. Like everything about that tree. And I'm like, me personally, I'd like, nope. We're going. Nope, not it. So they definitely helped with that on the set. It was very creepy. The corpsicle thing. It's like I met the corpsicle before I met the real people. So I was like, oh, that's what you look. I know what you look like.
Yeah, the corpsicle is a real like feat of engineering. Just like the first time you see that as a viewer, it's like, oh, this shit is real.
Yeah, the shit is real.
So you mentioned before being a fan of the original show. As you know, like part of the True Detective experience is, you know, looking for clues and dissecting it. And I love how many Easter eggs there are. But the opening credits seem like they have a lot of tiny details in them. I don't know how closely you've watched them. Is there something in there that you think viewers should be paying close attention to?
Just pay attention to backstories, pay attention to who's who with every character, because there are some connections with some characters. The spiral is a big obvious one. The spiral connects the supernatural, magical aspect that we loved so dearly about the first season. Don't blink, especially not even just related to any seasons, because every season is an entity of itself, but just to realize if you catch the clues along the way to try to figure out the case, just don't blink, because there are clues every scene, every person, every set, every everything. So just pay close attention, especially to people's backstories.
Did you solve the mystery before you found out the end?
No. Issa is a master at that. I'm like, oh, snap. Like, I had no idea. It was a pleasant surprise. And then to see actually on screen, even though I knew it was going to happen, it still hits. It still hits hard. Like, okay.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Kaylee.
Thank you so much.
Still watching. We'll be back in just a moment. And when we return, our little Scooby Squad will try to predict who the murderers are.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Okay, guys, it is once again prediction time. We have an IC on the line for the winner. Chris, last week, you were saying that you think...
It was the polar bear, of course.
It's the polar bear.
Speaking of laws.
Do you still think that the one-eyed polar bear is behind everything?
Oh, God, I would love if it were, but no, I'm going to...
I mean, it's like, you know, it's a spirit of, like, the wild, like, coming back
wild,
to reclaim.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Coming against, you know, the miners and the men who destroyed
There's
the
actually
land.
A Connie Britton movie about that, about a researchers in an Alaskan station and some sort of, like, animal spirits attack them.
That's what Friday Night Lights is about.
the notorious second season.
Yeah. Okay. The writer's trick. That's right.
And then they went back to Dylan.
Jesse Plemons kills a polar bear.
Yeah, exactly. It was horrible. Yeah,
well, I'm so glad that I went with that for last week. This week, I'm gonna tether it back. Even though we're getting more supernatural and more like a horror movie, I'm gonna tether it back a little bit to reality and go back. We had this new guy, right? Otis, but I'm still kind of obsessed with Oliver Tadak. I don't know. Do you think we'll never see him again? The spiral being everywhere in his house. The thing about the generator in the caves, he might know where the caves are. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe he's retreated to the caves. Maybe we find him there. Maybe
there's a whole community there.
A whole community of cave people. I don't think...
I'm sorry. Now I'm seeing, like, people in, like, loincloths going, like,
or like, the Matrix sequel where they're all having a rave underground. Yeah.
Oh, God, I would love that. But, yeah, I'm going to say him, even though I don't expect the killer to be...
But he's involved.
He's involved. I don't think he's maybe the main killer. He killed Annie Kay, necessarily, because I don't think that this show would necessarily do Native-on-Native violence. I don't think it's necessarily going to be a Native person who's responsible for
unless
this.
Unless it's a tragic accident or something like that.
Yes, unless there's some big mistake or whatnot. But he's the person that's stuck in my craw. Right
now. You know, talking about people and the mine and everything, we haven't seen the mine owner. We haven't talked about the mine owner.
No, it's just that woman.
In a while. Yeah, Kate.
I mean, she shows up and then she kind of does Danvers a solid by not calling the police.
On Leah, yeah. But I do wonder if, you know, her being involved...
Well, I mean, not pressing charges. Right. Danvers is the police. But,
No, it's Jodie Foster. She's an actress.
Oh, okay.
No, I mean, her being, you know, reintroduced kind of feels, I don't know, maybe we should consider her in the end game. And if the mine somehow, if the scientists, like, knew too much killed them in a mysterious, weird way and then is, like, trying to, you know, brush it under the rug. Mm. Like, I feel like that could be, maybe that's also kind of a predictable solution.
Well,
but if the mine is behind both Annie Kay and the scientists.
The mine is looming over this show for a reason, right?
Yeah.
It's killing babies. It's making people sick. I kind of am with you on that, Hillary. Like, my theory last week was that it was some sort of chemical. I still kind of think there's something that's hallucinogenic.
Something
involved.
That was released.
Yeah. But I think that, like, it was a terrible accident when Clark, because they went to this cave. He wanted to show her this amazing thing they discovered, but didn't realize that the cave was making him crazy. He killed Annie sort of by accident.
Mm-hmm. But also because of the cave juice.
I don't know how that explains the power going out. And then the mine found out about it, covered everything up because we have to stop mining if we're releasing this horrible chemical in the air.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the scientists knew about it, so they had to cover that up. And, you know, so it's conspiracy upon
conspiracy.
I mean,
I'm not sure why the mine would kill the scientists in that particular manner.
Well, they just released the gas, and the gas did its work.
And the gas obviously.
There are cleaner ways of doing that. Open the door. Polar bear walks in. Close the door behind the polar bear.
One-eyed polar bear. Again, it's all going to be the polar bear. I'm calling it now.
Yeah. Getting them to strip and, like, go out onto the ice and tear out their own eyes and everything.
And folding their clothes afterwards.
Yes, it's rather Baroque, maybe, for a corporation.
I have become convinced, though, at the very least, that whoever killed Annie Kay is not who killed the scientists.
Yeah.
I think they're obviously related.
But they're not.
But they're not the same villain.
Okay, because that's just too neat.
I think if the show is pointing itself toward both thriller and horror, but also tragedy, drama, I think that the Annie Kay death is going to be revealed to be something. I mean, she got stabbed so many times, so it was very violent. But, like, I don't know. I think there's something sort of more, like, pathetic and sad about that.
But it's not accidental. Like,
No, it's not some accidental, like,
intentional.
I didn't mean to strangle her kind of thing.
Yeah, but not necessarily the same as the scientist.
I mean, I can get behind that.
Well, we'll see.
Very soon.
Well, that does it for this episode of Still Watching. You can find me, as ever, on social media at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And you can find me on social media at Christris.
You can find me at Hillibuster.
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. We had technical assistance from Jake Loomis. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer, and our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next Sunday for episode 5, the penultimate episode. Looking forward to seeing you then.
The Run for Revogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.